invitation to give this talk at this beautiful meeting at this beautiful institute here. And in fact, what I would like to go to do in this talk is to describe to you what I think is the most important, perhaps, open problem or the real challenge, perhaps, for the next generation of calculations that should further show the viability of the asymptotic safety scenario, in particular in the context of the gravitational average action approach. Now, this subtitle I should explain to you, Past and Future, is just an approximation for a somewhat longer sentence. It's not to mean that I'm going to review the past and try to predict the future, but rather what I'm going to talk about is some crucial feature of this approach, the average action approach, that we sort of got for free in the past, but we have to pay for in the future, or have to work a little bit harder for it in the future. And future here concretely means when we go on to use more elaborate truncations, better approximations. And what I'm referring to here is the famous problem all people basically face working on quantum gravity: what makes quantum gravity different from all other quantum field theories, and that's the problem of background independence. Now, to start with, let me give you a very perhaps simple-minded definition of what I mean by background independence. There could be a lot of objections to it, but let's accept the following simple-minded description, namely that we would like the theory of quantum gravity that we are going to formulate to share a certain feature with classical general relativity, namely no special metric, something you would like to call a vacuum in standard field theory. No such special metric should play a distinguished role in the formulation of the general rules and also in the concrete computations you are doing. So all your constructions should work without having something like what I call a priori background, like the Minkowski metric, for instance, at your disposal. And for instance, something like the metric of space-time in a certain state you would like to obtain as the expectation value of a certain operator, call it gamma hat here. Now, of course, there would be a lot more that could be said about this problem. I just want to point out that there are, in principle, two radically different ways how you can try to cope with this difficulty. Option one is that in all your calculations, you really do not use any background structures, never, ever, neither in the formulation of the rules nor in the concrete computations. You pick any classical background space-time, quantum quantum gravity, or the redshift CDP approaches are a little bit of that sort. You might, for instance, start from a trivial state that has a metric expectation value that is identically zero, and then you would really try very hard to find states, call them semi-classical, for instance, that would make this expectation value something that is reminiscent of what we call space-time metric usually, that is non-degenerate and smooth. So this is option one. And this is certainly the most straightforward way of implementing background independence, but clearly it's a very ambitious and a very difficult one. The option number two, that is something that is implemented in the effective average action, for instance, that is what I call in this context a biometric approach. Why biometric? Well, the idea here is you choose a certain background, but it's absolutely arbitrary. You never fix it concretely, just as a kind of theoretical construct, you assume there exists a background, then you do the quantization of the dynamical fields at hand, and in the end, you have to verify that nothing, no physical result, depends on your choice. You'll be noted in your new bar, depends on your choice of a background structure metric here concretely. So in the most simple-minded setting, this idea is implemented by starting from some path integral over metric, say gamma mu nu, and then decomposing the integration variable or the dynamical variable, generally speaking, the operator, so to speak, into a background piece g bar and the fluctuation term h nu nu. With h nu nu, then you quantize as a nonlinear fluctuation on a classical background space time with metric g bar. It might develop a certain expectation value, h nu nu bar, so that the expectation value of your complete metric operator is something like background piece plus h bar. And this h bar mu nu then does depend, that's the sort of feat we have to get used to. It depends on your choice of g bar, and you never, I repeat, you never make any concrete choice for g bar, but you keep it a variable. One thing you could do, for instance, is to look for self-consistent backgrounds, backgrounds for which this, we call it a correction, h bar mu nu vanishes. That would be one way of giving a specific value to g bar that you could do perhaps at the end of all your computations, but it is not assumed that you do this step at any intermediate level of developing the theory. So roughly speaking, the option number two, the biometric approach, is the idea that background independence is implemented not looking at any background, but by looking at all possible backgrounds at a time. So in a certain sense, what we try to do, at least philosophically, so to speak, is to quantize the fluctuations on all possible backgrounds at a time. In a sense, to make this point perhaps a bit clearer, the distinction between option one and option two, you could compare the situation between discussing, let's say, a simple scale of theory from the perspective of the broken phase or the phase with unbroken C2 symmetry. You could compare the metric expectation value with the condensate phi, the expectation value of the scalar. And then, in a sense, the option number two, the one that we are going to implement, is a little bit like you expand about the true expectation value, non-zero expectation value in the broken phase. And for us, it is really conceptually important then that this broken phase in this picture corresponds to a non-degenerate metric. In the option number one, so to speak, you work from the point of view, you start from the, so to speak, the metric with unbroken, or the theory without symmetry breaking, psi expectation value, or the metric expectation value, in this case, is zero. In the gravitational setting, you would this call, you start from a phase with unbroken diffeomorphism invariant. If the metric expectation value is zero, nothing is there that breaks the diffeomorphisms down to something as small as the Lorentz group, for instance. So that's a vague analogy to look at these two differences, and as I said, we shall use option number two from now on. Now, yes.
H is necessarily small.
No, it's not assumed. And actually, this is only an abbreviation. This G bar plus H, you could think of a kind of Riemann normal coordinate expansion in the space of all electrons.
Yeah, the question I have is, I mean, that you don't impose any conditions on the determinant, say, and they're not compatible with this. So if I say, what must they have, say, negative determinant or positive, say, if I'm in Euclidean, probably H can be anything here. So
well, in the ultimate formulation of the theory, one should do that, but for the time being, no. There is no meaningful way yet.
You're just ignoring this question.
Of including fluctuations that are so strong that they would overwhelm a G bar so that it could change the determinant or could make it zero and so on. But you are right, in the end, one would have to do that
process. But, I mean, in how far does this differ from the standard picture to the one that always is in the background in field formulation? The one point function, I mean, that the functional measure is simply normalized such that the one point function of your actuation field is quite fixed.
I'm just reviewing the full story. I'm not saying there was anything new yet. I just want to start from scratch and finally explain and motivate what I think are these next important steps.
I mean, just if you would do this for the normal situation you just mentioned of symmetric spontaneous circuit breaking, one way to recuperate your structure would be at the end to check for Takashi identities,
yes.
Okay, which is a subset of the equation.
Yes, I must apologize, but most of these conferences are in a somewhat cartoon-like style, and I'm not going through all technical details, but that's exactly what will be one of the challenges and tasks for the future.
I have a conceptual question about background independence. Why do we think that insisting on background independence in this term form is a good idea? Because if you look at the examples from string theory, where we know what quantum gravity looks like in ABS CFT, you know the big lesson there was that any explicit realization of quantum gravity is very sensitive to very specific details that you specify for boundary conditions. You have the boundary of that space-time. So, in that sense, background independence is precisely orthogonal to the ideology that seems to be coming out of the ABCFT.
Maybe.
Why is this?
No, I mean, the main motivation is that classical general relativity, for instance, has this a property. And for instance, if you have the ambition of explaining why space-time is what it is, then we should better not put in any a priori prejudice about.
But in strict theory, we are learning a lot about what space-time is, but we are learning it at the cost of having boundary conditions at infinity. So those are the realizations that work. Why do you insist on precisely the opposite?
No, why do you insist on precisely the opposite?
We keep this up. I
understand that there are many questions, but as I said, we reserved a half an hour before we started to discuss ourselves. Allow Martin to.
So now let me come to a second completely a priori unrelated question and unrelated difficulty with quantum gravity. Namely, if you want to formulate perhaps a quantum theory of gravity in a field theory language, you would like to apply modern renormalization group techniques along the lines of Wilson. And then you might ask, for instance, what means coarse graining in quantum gravity? When there is a dynamical metric, what is the meaning of coarse graining? What means coarse? What means fine with respect to what metric or ideas? Naive pictures of block spin transformations. What is the analog of a block spin, the size of a block? How do you measure that? Who measures it? What metric measures it? I'm not saying that these difficulties cannot be overcome. I'm just saying it's a difficulty and it's a new feature when you go from metal field theories on non-dynamical space times, you go on to quantum gravity. From a very down-to-earth point of view, if you look at the, for instance, this flow equation that is written on the wall of the black hole, this ball, you immediately realize if you want to write down a cutoff operator and you have no metric available, you will not be able to define something like horse craning without a metric, at least not in that framework. So what do you do? Well, option one, where you do not assume as a help the intermediate existence, for technical purposes, the intermediate existence of a background metric. Well, option one, there you must generate sort of all scales from within the theory. That's a little bit like the discussion of what is time in quantum gravity. You have to perhaps introduce systems which you might call a clock, or you might call it a rod, and with those you could perhaps measure what is the size of a block of spins and so on. Clearly, again, this is not impossible, but it's a very difficult task. Option two instead is something that is very easy, or has a very simple option. Now, if you follow option two, you have your unspecified background metric available, and you can do a kind of generalized covariantized Fourier analysis by means of the Laplacian that is constructed from this G bar mu mu. Take this operator, at least in principle, you can diagonalize it, find eigenfunctions, phi lambda, with eigenvalues minus lambda, expand your dynamical field by R in terms of those eigenfunctions, and then say, insist that the eigenvalues are smaller than some maximum eigenvalue, then this means that you do some covariant horse graining, a very obvious generalization of what you would do on flat space with a Fourier analysis. But what is new and sometimes makes difficulties in interpreting your result, what is new is that this maximum, or the smallest, let's say the smallest scale that is resolved in such an expansion, it depends on the maximum eigenvalue, that's clear, but it also depends functionally now on the choice of your background. But apart from that, things are pretty straightforward now. In fact, now let's continue with the biometric approach and let's put these things together. Namely, let's assume we start from some formal path in the curl over matrix gamma mu nu with some diffeomorphism invariant action. Then the first step is the same as in perturbation theory. You introduce gauge fixing condition, you introduce ghosts, you insert the split, you switch to h mu nu as the variable of integration. Then the next step, not just talking about horse graining, the next step in perturbation theory or some perturbative studies is to cut to sources and produce an effective action. And if you dream that you might have computed exactly this effective action, then all the endpoint functions of your fluctuation field can be computed by differentiating this functional with respect to the fluctuation field, H bar is its average, at a fixed background G bar. So this is the ordinary effective action here, and at this point I would like to introduce a new notation, which is totally trivial as a notation. It gives a sort of different emphasis
as for these two arguments here. Namely, instead of writing gamma as a functional of H bar and G bar, you also can write it as a functional of two metrics. The relation is very simple. The H bar is nothing but G minus G bar. G is the full quantum expectation value of the metric, and the difference relative to the background is the expectation value of the fluctuation. Now, these two presentations of the same functionals are emphasizing different aspects. The first notation here emphasizes the biometric aspect of this approach. You always have two metrics to deal with. That's the price you have to pay. And this other notation with a semicolon here emphasizes the aspect that you have a given background manifold on which a certain quantum field H mu nu propagates. In this notation, it becomes clear that what we are actually doing is we treat a certain matter field in a classical background, and treating this matter field in all sorts of backgrounds, and as you say, controlling their relation by ward identities, that is the task here. Now, you can do one thing that is well known. Up to now, I've said only very well known thing. One thing you can do is you can pick a specific gauge fixing condition, namely a gauge fixing condition of the background gauge type. So here, the word background gauge appears in a different meaning. Background gauge is a gauge which has the property that the resulting functional gamma is invariant under general coordinate transformations, diffeomorphism, when both of the arguments are transformed. So this delta disk in U nu is concretely a Lie derivative of the metric along some generating vector field. So that's more or less for free. If you get to such a term, you can make it a functional that depends diffeomorphically invariant on two tensor fields, G and G bar. So what you get, for instance, if you want to do a derivative expansion under no simplifying circumstances whatsoever, what you have to consider is a derivative expansion that contains all sorts of mixed terms of tensors made from G and made from G bar. So this is Einstein-Hilbert of both cases. This is a mixed term, this is another mixed term, and so on. So roughly speaking, in this setting, what you are dealing with are these complicated functionals, and the price of background independence at that level is this dependence on two metrics. And you also see some sort of annoying feature, namely if you now put a G bar to a fixed value, let's say the Minkowski metric, what you get here is just some sort of complicated expression in terms of the dynamical metric G, but it has no nice covariance property. Namely, this diffeomorphism invariance, it does not constrain the form of this object very nicely. So the full invariance of all these constructions is seen nicely only as long as you keep G bar really completely arbitrary. And now, but it will not help. That's essentially a way of saying the message of my thought. There will be a word identity, but it does not help much for this challenge I would like to describe. Now, there is the famous metric of the background gauge, and the metric, so to speak, of the background gauge is. And that's also the reason why you perhaps are not never encountered this horrible object here. In standard field theory computations, there is a functional gamma bar which has two equal arguments, G equals G bar or H bar set to zero in the other notation. And this functional with the two metrics identified is enough to compute, for instance, the S matrix element for, let's say, graviton-graviton scattering in a flat space background. This is a well-known result, and usually this means that you do not have to compute the dependence as a function of P and P bar, but it's enough to compute this gamma bar, which has put its fluctuation average to zero. And differentiating this object with respect to G bar produces the same on-shell S matrix element as the other calculation, which we did before, so to speak, differentiated with respect to H bar and put H bar to zero. That's the simplifying feature in standard applications. Now we come to a question. You might ask, what is special about this tensor field now? In what respect is H mu different from the field that describes the tensor method, say? And the answer clearly is it combines with G bar to the full space-time metric to which all matter couples, and it describes or encodes the dynamics of matter form. Next question, how is this feature reflected by gamma? Well, at the level of the classical action, you see it is encoded by a very simple split symmetry. Split symmetry means S depends only on the sum, G bar plus A, so changing a little bit G bar by plus epsilon mu nu and subtracting the same amount from H mu nu, you don't change the full gamma, so you don't change any physics. This is the classical statement, and at the level of the effective action, there are now indeed warp-like identities which look like this. You perform a split symmetry in the arguments of gamma. What you get back is the untransformed gamma, and then there are certain correction terms which one could write down, but are not very instructive now. And these correction terms, however, are inconsequential when you compute physical quantities such as S matrix elements, every matrix element. And well, this is a first source now of a violation of split symmetry which we encounter. Where do they come from? Well, they have, again, very well-known origin. As I said, up to here, everything is completely standard. And this origin is simply the gauge-fixing functional. We appropriate, as I called it before, gauge-fixing functionals. We use those of the background type are typically something like an operator depending on G bar acting on the fluctuation, the whole thing squared. And this gauge fixing term has the property that it depends on H and G bar separately and not only on their sum. So this gauge fixing term, contrary to the classical action, breaks split symmetry. But that's under control and no reason to worry. Okay, so far everything was textbook-like. Now let's introduce the infrared cutoff or the coarse graining operator into the path integral. Up to now we have an integral over H, but we have Popov ghosts, and in addition we now put a suppression term that suppresses long wavelength in a covariant sense, long wavelength term contribution to this path integral. This is done by adding a quadratic functional to the action upstairs, quadratic in the fluctuations H here and in the ghost C bar C. In between there is a certain kernel of this structure, consists of a set of constants times a scale k squared And then there is a function called shape function, which has this profile here. It contains the covariant Laplacian in its argument over k squared. The meaning of this addition here is that with this term, you add something like a mass term to the action of the fluctuations when their momentum is small. When you are in this regime, the argument is here is below 1, and you add something like k squared times the constant to the inverse propagator, and for a large d basket, for large covariant momenta, you are here and you don't add anything. So this is the covariantized suppression of long, in quotes and quotes, long wavelength modes. And the remaining steps then again are the same as before. You couple your dynamical fields to sources. You Lechendre transform the resulting generating functional W. You subtract, that's not so important, the suppression functional, the coarse graining functional with the classical, with the average, the expectation value fields inserted. The C bar and the C are the expectation values of C bar and C. And then what you get is the so-called effective average action. These are essentially very much the same steps as what Christoph Petterich had done for the classical, for the scalar case. Now again, this average action, you can have two attitudes towards it. In the case of gravity, you either can say you have something like a matter field H bar coupled to classical gravity, or you can adopt this biometric ideology and say it depends on two metrics and two ghost fields. Now, by construction, this object generalizes the standard effective action. For k equals 0, you recover that. Second, it is diffeomorphism invariant under changes, under transformations of all its arguments, p, p bar, p, p bar. If you act with the corresponding diffeomorphism generators, then it's unchanged. And third, you can prove that it satisfies a function of the normalization group equation of the usual form. On the right-hand side, it has a Hessian gamma k2. And that's important now for what is to follow at fixed, computed at fixed backgrounds, G bar. So this is the operator or the matrix consistent of second functional derivatives with respect to H bar, G bar at fixed G bar. So here you can see quite explicitly that if you want to renormalization group evolve such an object, you cannot set H bar to 0 before the evolution. You can do that only after the evolution. The transport of this object from one scale to another is in a space which consists of such functionals depending on two metrics and two ghosts. If you try to violate this rule, nothing will make any sense anymore, because if you have a diffeomorphism invariant functional and take the Hessian, then that will have zero modes and nothing here will exist. So this is, in a sense, the first way to describe the price we have to pay for background independence. If we want a Wilson-like flow on a certain theory space, this theory space doesn't consist just of functionals depending on one metric, but the very least is it depends on two metrics and two ghosts. Now let me introduce a term that will be very crucial later on. Namely, let me call this in the notation with a comma here in this two metric or biometric notation, let me call the G bar dependence an extra tree bar dependence to emphasize a certain point, namely, also tree in a way depends on the background or contains the background, but combined with the fluctuation. And extra means this is a tree bar that does not combine with the fluctuation average to form a full metric. In that sense, it is extra. So here is an extra g-bar dependence. You know already one source of such extra g-bar dependencies, and you know that it doesn't matter really at the physics level, namely the gauge fixing term produces such an extra dependence. And now there is another source, the one we are concerned about here, another source of extra g-bar dependence, namely the one where the one that is responsible for the coarse grain, this delta Ks functional has, and is crucial that it has an extra g-bar dependence. You could not write down this coarse graining kernel without having a metric. You need a metric just to be able to contract indices and to declare what is long and what is short wavelength. So it is a very, it's a matter of principle which comes from our general setting, is at the root of our general setting that we introduce such an extra g-bar dependence by the coarse graining. So here is a little list of very different tasks.
One point, the object you just defined is defined via a functional integral in the G,
yeah,
correct? And you define this coarse graining function which provides an infrared regulator.
Yes.
What is the attitude with respect to ultraviolet divergences in the functional integral?
the derivation of the flow equation is only formal.
Mm-hmm.
And what we are going to do is we take the equation, the flow equation seriously. We compute flows, we find trajectories that hit an ultraviolet fixed point. And knowing this trajectory, we can, and this has started only last year, this is an additional ingredient to this program. And knowing this, you can try to reconstruct a regularized functional integral with an ultraviolet cutoff, which reproduces that trajectory which you found by solving the flow equation. This is a very indirect.
So let me just ask methodologically, the way that Steve presented it this morning was a little bit different. I'm wondering why you don't follow that. He imposed an ultraviolet cutoff, and then within the presence of the ultraviolet cutoff, you can define, you know, since you also have an infrared cutoff, that the functional integral is fully defined. Then you can derive the renormalization group flow equations. Then you can seek to find a critical surface which will allow you to take the limit where the ultraviolet cutoff goes away. Why don't you do it in that order?
Well, I could say I'm doing that because when I have the flow equation, the ultraviolet cutoff drops out. I could say I start from a path integral that is regularized. Then I derive the flow equation. It has both infrared and an ultraviolet cutoff. And at the level of the flow equation, I can sort of trivially remove the ultraviolet cutoff. But when I want to go back from a solution to the flow equation to the path integral, I have to sort of reinstate the ultraviolet cutoff.
Mm-hmm.
So the object that we are computing from the flow equation is sort of more universal than a regularized path integral. You can derive many regularized path integrals from one solution to the flow equation. So the set of two things in principle gives you one functional integral. First, the trajectory of this equation, and second, the ultraviolet regularization. And in fact, there will be a talk, Elisa Hartmann-Rinke will describe precisely that.
In fact, there will also be a talk, mine, which does exactly what you said.
So it's okay if I conceive of it fully cut off and regulated. Okay.
So as for the significance of the background fields, or the background field technique in this context, it has three, in this case, logically completely different, serves different purposes. The first one is it makes gamma a diffeomorphism invariant functional of its arguments. And this is achieved by means of the gauge fixing terms of the type proposed by the Diffeos, Abbott and others, namely those that are invariant under simultaneous coordinate transformations of both entries here, of both the fluctuation and the background. So this is the background gauge technique, as it's sometimes called. This is what we are using. The second use is, that is what I discussed with Christoph Wetterich together long ago for the Young-Mills case. You can do a Kadanoff-Wilson-like coarse training in a gauge covariant way if you cut off your modes by means of the background Laplacian, organized according to the background Laplacian. And here the background field is important because you cannot use the full dynamical field, otherwise the structure of the flow equation would change. So that's the second stage. And the third stage is for gravity, where you do not want there to be any distinguished a priori background. This technique can bring you back into the situation of sort of conventional field theory, because the A bar or the G bar can serve as a standard background, even though it's non-standard in the sense that you don't really choose anything concrete. Okay, so that's the task. The task is to solve this flow equation for such functionals in a way as precise as possible. And what has been done now, of course, is not with any exact solutions, but truncated ones on truncated theories basis. And there is, first of all, a very general class of truncations within which all existing calculations fit. And this general class of truncations looks as follows. What is done here is the ghost terms and the gauge fixing terms are kept classical. First of all, keeping the ghost term classical means that the CC bar dependence is the classical one. Then you are left with a functional of two metrics. Any functional of two metrics without loss of generality, you can write in this form, gamma bar plus gamma hat, where gamma bar is, so to speak, the diagonal. It is the full gamma with both metrics equal, no ghosts. And gamma hat, by definition, has no diagonal contribution. So when both these metrics are equal, gamma hat, by definition, is zero. And everything is carried by gamma bar. And all deviations from G equals G bar, so to speak, are carried by gamma hat. I should also say that this S gauge fixing is a functional of this type here, at least for our choices. It's a kind of gamma hat type functional. Now, that's if you keep the ghost action classical, this is still very general. But what has been done from the first paper to almost all papers which explored flows in a complicated or in a yeah which explored flows in this setting, this gamma hat was neglected. Now there are many reasons to neglect this. For instance, you can show to lowest order BRF invariant requires this to be absent. Another reason is at k equals zero you can easily see that it vanishes identically
also there is very concrete evidence from computations in Yang-Mills theory where omitting this term and working only with the rest gave very almost precise, very successful leaded what used in terms of truncations. It's sort of reproduced perturbation theory. So as a starting point and also from the later experience, it was a good guess to say this gamma hat should be zero in a first attempt. So it was kept zero. And then generalizing gamma bar more and more, what has been found by, I also try to collect all names, but I apologize if I was not completely successful. What one finds is that according to all those truncations of this subspace considered, the RG flow of the effective average action is such that there seems to exist a non-trivial fixed point and seems suitable for taking an infinite cutoff limit along the lines of the asymptotic safety scenario. And that also in other respects, for instance, the finite dimensionality of the ultraviolet critical surfaces, this object gamma k seems to realize the scenario proposed by Steven Weinberg in precisely 30 years ago. So that was the findings in a nutshell. I will just show you one, the most primitive example of such a flow, because it will be needed later on as a reference, namely the Einstein-Hilbert truncation, where only Newton's and the cosmological constant are treated as running parameters converted to dimensionless numbers, little g and little lambda, by means of appropriate factors of k. What you get is, from the exact equation, a simple system of two coupled ordinary differential equations. And solving those, one finds this picture, which is in four dimensions, clearly shows, besides the Gaussian fixed point, non-Gaussian fixed point everywhere in the upper half plane. When you increase your scale k, you are attracted into this fixed point. So that was one example, and according to the analysis of the much more complicated calculations that are available by now, mostly done by our chairman and his collaborators, this picture seems to survive as a projection from a higher dimensional theory space. Now, let us ask what is really the mistake that one potentially makes in equating G and G bar at too early a stage. Let's distinguish single metric truncations, those with gamma hat equals zero, from the bimetric truncations where it's kept different from zero. Here again, it's the action. The only approximation is that the ghosts are kept classical. This is the definition of gamma bar, both metrics equal, and gamma hat for two equal metrics is zero. Now, if you insert this still general ansatz into the exact flow equation, what you get is an equation for the scale derivative of the sum. It equals a certain trace functional t depending on g and g bar. And explicitly, it is one half trace, then an inverse a propagator, the inverse of gamma bar 2, the Hessian of gamma bar, the Hessian of gamma hat, the Hessian of the gauge fixing term, and then comes the cutoff operator, which depends on G bar. That's important. Here is a G dependence, and the rest are G bar dependencies. plus a similar contribution from the ghosts. So this is easily decoupled into two equations. The two equations for, I mean, it's written in terms of two equations, which, however, are coupled for gamma bar and gamma hat. The first one for gamma bar involves the trace functional with G and G bar equal, but under the trace there appears gamma hat. And the gamma hat equation is this one on the right hand side, there is G of G and G bar, and subtracted is G of G and G. So this would be the equations to be solved in the bimetric case. Single metric truncations are those where you set gamma hat equals to zero in the first equation and you completely discard the second one. Now, when is it meaningful to discard the second equation? Clearly, it's meaningful when the right-hand side is small, when it's consistent with the K evolution to put it to zero. If it's zero in the beginning, it stays zero. So the condition for the single metric truncation to be meaningful is that this difference is small, or stated differently, that the extra gamma bar dependence is small. If this is the case, then it's a good idea to set gamma hat equals to zero. And in this case, the first equation assumes this form. This is the equation that always has been used. Then the G bars in the cutoff operator has become G's now, as it happened before already in the gate fixing. So now also these two R Ks produce an extra G dependence. So now the coarse graining operator is sort of treated at the same logical level, or the G's in the coarse graining operator is treated at the same logical level as the G's in gamma bar 2. This is a honestly dynamical G, and this is one that is introduced to coarse grain. So there is a kind of, in this, the invariance in gamma bar, there is a certain contamination of true G dependencies with G bar dependencies, which are not disentangled now. And at least at first sight, this grows the impact or the importance of these contaminations grow at large K, because the smearing operators contain factors of K squared. So this is the key problem I'm going to address now. Is this a valid approximation or not? As I said, in Yang-Mills, there are various tests which show it's excellent in many cases, but what's about gravity? So the first question you can ask, is it at all of any relevance what you put inside RK, this metric? Is it important what you put here for the gravitational RP load? And the answer is yes, and I will show you this in the last few minutes by means of a simple toy model I worked on with Bolgovaya, namely conformally reduced Einstein gravity is a nice toy model which shows how crucial the choice of this operator is, and it also teaches you some other lessons. Then the second question is, well, given the fact that it is important what you do here, what happens if you generalize this toy model at least by introducing bimetric terms so you can disentangle G from G bar? Does it change much? And this is recent work with Elisa Manrique, and I will show you some results at the end. Well, what is conformally reduced gravity? That is something very simple. The idea is, instead of a complete metric gamma mu nu, you consider only metrics that are conformal to a given fiducial metric or reference metric G. tree hat. This tree hat here has nothing to do with the background. It has no analog in the full theory. It's just a way of expressing the fact that actually, instead of gamma mu nu, I just deal with the scale of. And this scale of theory, then, I treat using the same techniques as full gravity, namely the effective action plus the background field method.
The measure in the path integral has a delta function which tells you, coming from the Hamiltonian constraint, that tells you that this factor is constrained in the path integral to be in every trajectory a function of the energy momentum density. Do you lift that constraint?
No. That is, you should look at this model as a kind of toy model in its own right.
So it's not an approximation to generality.
No, it just has a certain crucial feature, same feature gravity has, and it's just a model to show you.
Okay.
The answer is yes to this first.
Okay, so you use the trivial measure.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And then we follow the usual steps. We do the same for the background. We make an additive split, background split for chi, as chi b is the background conformal factor plus a fluctuation. But there is a certain scalar expectation value, the one of chi, is chi b plus the fluctuation expectation value. So this is now very much similar to gravity. The full metric has a certain conformal factor times g hat. Everything is conformal to g hat. This is, now what you do is you take a certain truncation. You assume a certain form of the action
gamma k that mimics the Einstein-Hilbert truncation, or more generally the gamma hat equals zero truncations of gravity. Namely, you take the Einstein-Hilbert term and insert for p nu nu phi squared p hat. Then you get something very simple, namely a phi to the four theory. And I'm just doing these simple tricks to appeal to now to our knowledge and experience with phi to the four in one or another quantization scheme. So let's look at that and let's ask, how should I define the coarse graining operator now? There are two very different ways of doing that. In the first one, I define RK in this way, which has the effect that K has the interpretation of a cutoff in the spectrum of box hat. And box hat is supposed to mean the covariant Laplacian, which refers to this tree hat reference metric. Take flat space, for instance, refers to delta mu nu, that's the flat box, say. And then what you have here with this cutoff is nothing but the familiar phi to the four theory, actually minus phi to the four theory. This is the theory Simancic showed, that it is asymptotically three one. But in any case, it has nothing, apparently nothing to do with gravity. That's one choice. And this is a choice that is not the one dictated by background invariance. So this is a choice forbidden by background invariance, forbidden for gravity. Choice number two, you make K a cutoff in the spectrum of box bar, which differs from the other box by factors of the background conformal factor. If you do that, your coarse graining operator looks different, and then the RG flow looks entirely different, namely almost identical to that of full gravity. So there are extra factors of chi b, and these chi b's in a single metric truncation become phi's, in the same sense, g bar becomes g after the identification of arguments. So what you really find is a picture for the flow that is literally, almost literally, identical to the one from the Einstein-Hilbert truncation of full gravity. You have a non-Gaussian fixed point, and the structure of the trajectories is essentially the same. So that was the answer to the first question. This shows RK is crucial. It is very crucial. In particular, it is crucial because of this single metric truncation. The single metric truncation makes the background G bars dynamical G's, and this has a certain impact on the flow. It influences your beta functions. And now the question is, what happens if you add or if you do a bimetric truncation of the same theory? So let's keep certain terms of the gamma hat type. And this is what we did in ELISA. With ELISA recently, we took two such terms of Einstein-Hilbert type, inserted G is conformally related to delta mu nu. In this case, G bar is conformally related to delta mu nu. Then you get two such phi to the four actions. And then we also kept the term that is of this mixed G-G bar type. If I write it in that way, you might find it a bit funny, namely square root of square root G times square root G bar. This is certainly a term that is invariant under diffeomorphisms acting on both G and G bar. And the actual motivation for this particular example is that in the language of the scalar field, it has the character of a mass term for phi, a fixed chi. So for fixed background field, it's a mass term for the dynamical field. No, this is just the convention, but it will turn out negative in the end. Moreover, to define the flow, we now took that operator RK that is dictated by gravity, so we did not use the one for flat space metal field computations, but the background independent one, option number two before. What this results in is a five parameter flow. Phi and lambda are the, let's call them genuine Newton and cosmological constants. Then there is the running M and a background analog of Newton's constant and the cosmological constant. As I said, these new terms, they vanish at k equals zero. There is no extra background dependence then and no violation of the split symmetry. So what is very interesting here now is that you have two cosmological constants, for instance. The genuine one is the one that appears in the effective Einstein equation, has a non-zero value at k equals zero, whereas the other one that multiplies the volume element of the background metric has to vanish at k equals zero, and it has no impact on the curvature of space-time. It does not appear in the effective flow equation, not even at finite k. In the effective Einstein equation. So what was the result? Let's look at the situation near the Gaussian fixed point where eta and its background counterpart, the anomalous dimensions, are small, and also this new parameter is small in dimensionless form. Then what you find is the genuine cosmological constant goes like 1 over log k, the background one like k to the fourth, mk runs quadratically, and the Newton constants are approximately constant. Now, what we see here is absolutely familiar to you if you think in terms of a scalar theory. The phi to the fourth coupling runs logarithmically, the mass quadratically, this is a constant, the dwarfic divergences of the vacuum graph. So this is completely familiar when you interpret things in this 5 to the 4 scalar field language. On the other hand, this result is very surprising, and it is very different from its single metric counterpart if you think in terms of gravity. Namely, the genuine cosmological constant, this one, almost doesn't run. It has only a very, very weak logarithmic dependence on the scale, whereas this k to the fourth running, which everybody expects, for instance, from summing zero-point energies, everybody knows somewhere there is a quartic running of something like a cosmological constant. This quartic running appears in the background cosmological constant. So there is no quartic contribution to the vacuum energy density that would enter the effective Einstein equations. So in this approximation, or truncation at least, this famous 1/2 h bar omegas, which everybody is worrying about, they do not gravitate in that sense. They do not, or they're running at least, they gravitate, but not in a scale-dependent way. They are running, if you cut off the sum, does not show up in the curvature of space-time. And this is very different in the single metric truncation, namely lambda. If you don't distinguish lambda from lambda b, then the sum of the two neglects basically the log, and the sum of the two is a k to the fourth. And if you don't know that this is mostly background, then you would conclude that you have a very fast running. So this is one motivation why it's important to have to disentangle these modes with these dependencies. I should also say that nevertheless there is a quadratic running even in this truncation, a quadratic running in the effective field equation. And to make you a little bit unhappy now, if you thought this was a solution to the cosmological constant problem, it is not. And that you can see, for instance, if you use a little bit more general truncation, then you can recover a k to the four running also in the dynamical graph, also in the effective Einstein equation. But nevertheless, the way how scale dependencies of parameters manifest themselves at the level of sort of running Einstein equations, that's something I think should be reanalyzed in many cases, and this is something we are looking into. And now, of course, the crucial question is in this more general set of truncations, are there still fixed point, is asymptotic safety still alive? And in this model, the answer is yes, even though the changes of parameters are not small. This is, for instance, a plot of the trajectories near something which still exists. One has a total of four fixed points, two Gaussian ones and two non-Gaussian ones. This last one here is perhaps most closely related to what we do in a single metric truncation. These plots show various projections of always the same spirals in the M G, in the lambda M and the G lambda plane. So there is still a fixed point. It still has the same attractivity properties as before. You still could think of the asymptotic safety construction, but you should also be aware of the fact that there are considerable changes in quantities that we considered sort of universal, or in theory they are universal. Particle exponents are one example, and another one is this G star lambda star. Here it is 5.9, and in the single metric truncation this was 1.3. These numbers don't mean very much. I think a fair statement is to say that the changes due to the gamma hat term are larger than the scheme dependence in the single metric truncation. So this more or less means that you should look into what these gamma hat terms do. But one also should say this toy model is notoriously unstable, more unstable than full gravity. So in full gravity, there the situation might be better. So the conclusion is, as I said, is a subjective statement about what I think are the most important challenges for the next few years, and I believe that it is important and worthwhile to disentangle these GRT contributions, perhaps not for calculations which just are intended to provide a qualitative understanding of certain features, but at the level of precision calculations in truncations that should go beyond Roberto and company's huge R to the 9 calculations. If you want to compete with that or do better than that, you should start off thinking including such biometric type truncations. And the new picture then is that you should think of HMU as a kind of matter field that propagates in a background related to G bar mu nu, and that they are sort of relatively independent in the sense that SK is large or is non-zero, the split symmetry is strongly violated, so it's not a very simple obvious relationship of H to G. Well, and having said all that, if you are now curious to learn whether asymptotic safety is still alive, then you should come to the talk by Frank Sauer-Essig this week, who will present you with the results of a first truncation in full gravity with basically the same truncation I showed you before, the same biometric truncation as before, but not just the conformer factor included, but everything. And so that was my main topic, the thing I believe is the most, perhaps the most pressing thing to be done in the near future, but there are other kinds of problems I believe will become gradually important. And one of them is precisely what Lee was asking about, namely something one could call a reconstruction problem. What we are doing, as I said, what we are doing is we solve a completely regular flow equation without an ultraviolet cutoff. It is inspired by the quantum gravity path integral, but it's not a rigorous derivation, because you could, at the level of gamma k flows, you could forget about the ultraviolet cutoff. And so what is important somehow is to understand how you can reconstruct, sort of regularize the path integral from flows of the effective action. Given a measure, you would then find something like a bare action. And also you could then at that point, only at that point, you could hope to recover something that actually we do not know yet. Namely, what is the theory we actually quantize in asymptotic safety? We have an effective fixed point, but we don't know at the effective level. But S lambda, this object depending on ultraviolet cutoff, this is closely related to it, but it's not precisely the same. And Elisa will explain to you how you can, in principle, find this S lambda. There was some work on that, but not on the Hamiltonian description here. And another project I just want to mention, we are working on that with Jan-Erik Daum, but there is no final results yet. Another class of problems for the future is that one perhaps should not insist on using the metric as the carrier field of the degrees of freedom. You could also think of something like the field-by-spin connection formalism. And what we are trying to do is to evolve something like Holst's action and look, for instance, what the inertia parameter does in this foreign text, but this is something for the future, and perhaps in a few months I can tell you more on that. Thank you.
And I note that we have almost consumed entirely also this time for the discussion, but I think there is still worthwhile to have some discussion, and I propose that we merge questions related specifically to this talk with the broader questions that you may have. So,
I'd like to raise an issue which I think has been unduly neglected, the dependence of the MRK, any type of background detective acting on the choice of the age condition. So to the best of my knowledge, all the MRK studied in the
Zeran,
and the associated beta functions depend on the choice of age.
Yes, but that's not a matter of principle. That's again just a matter of a simple truncation. In principle, you should not pull out this S gauge fixing out of gamma hat. It's just part of gamma hat, and gamma hat runs, and S gauge fixing runs. So this is another point where you see that you seem to do something nonsensical, which actually isn't nonsensical if you are not general enough with your truncation. This dependence will go away if you allow the parameters to run, then.
No, my feeling is that it's not so much linked to that. It's more linked to the fact that the standard field theoretical arguments, which tell you that the background protective action is actually dependent on shell, so there's a form.
I fully agree, but this is a point which we never use in this program of solving our equation and perhaps even the constructing a path in the crow. This I just said in the introduction to put things in the proper perspective. I agree that might fail terribly, and it is not. And also this, the use of all that is in a flat background, which you might not have and is not general enough. So. That's just for historical.
Yeah, I have a general question of all the results, and it's a very simple question. We do know of an asymptotically safe extension of general relativity in four dimensions, which is the theory R plus the cosmological constant plus Weyl squared plus Ricci scalar squared. And this theory can be studied in perturbation theory because it happens to be renormalizable, and also if you follow the prescription to make the dimensional cutoffs, the dimensional constant proportional to cutoff and scale them and so forth, you find that lambda and g are represented by a non-trivial fixed point, much as in your results, and the coefficient of Weyl squared is asymptotically free, so altogether they're asymptotically safe, and the coefficient of R squared is mixed up with gauge fixing terms and so forth. So is it fair to ask the question, when you do your truncations and you search for a non-trivial fixed point and you find one, is it perhaps possible that you have rediscovered that theory? That is, since we already know the existence of that theory.
No, that is, I mean, the point is, for instance, you can, of course, not at a high numerical level, but if you take that theory you are mentioning and you omit all the R squared stuff, then from this perturbative perspective you were mentioning, this is a hell of a difference.
Well, but let me ask.
Not at all. For instance, the flow of G and lambda doesn't change much whether or not you have this R squared pieces.
But that's in some sense my point. I mean, I guess what I'm searching for is one of three things are true. One of them is you have rediscovered that theory in a different method, and that's good. Two is that you discovered two theories, That is, your method of truncation, looking at larger and larger truncations, should have found two fixed points, if they're distinct theories. And if you found only one fixed point, and it agrees as far as the truncations are concerned, the two theories agree with roughly where those fixed points are, how do we know they're not the same
theory? Well, I think this the theory you are mentioning with only r plus r squared.
But that's not the theory I'm mentioning. The theory I'm mentioning can only be studied if you have r in four dimensions. You have r plus r squared, r plus cosmological constant plus bio squared plus r scalar squared. So
yes, and this theory, I mean, that would not correspond to a fixed point. I think it's a
problem. It does correspond. If you follow the procedure, it does correspond precisely to a non-trivial fixed point in the plane of the dimensional coupling constants associated with the Newton's constant and the cosmological constant.
And all other terms are zero?
Well, the coefficient of Weyl squared is asymptotically free, and the coefficient of Ricci scalar squared depends on how you do the gauge fixing.
But for instance, R cubed.
Because it seems
very unlikely in a four-dimensional theory to have such a simple, exact fixed point.
Well, it happens to be renormalizable. That's been known for many, many years.
And I should not look at it as a perturbation of the Gaussian around the fixed point.
No, if you follow the procedure that you recommend and that Steve recommends, which I think is the correct procedure, then the fixed point is non-Gaussian. That is, it's non-Gaussian in the functions, the cutoff dependence functions associated with dimensional constants.
But Lee, it's renormalizable if you apply perturbation theory in a certain way.
Right.
But does that way break down when you get to the large scales where you approach the fixed point?
No.
Well, I always assumed it did.
Well, there.
Maybe no. You're right.
I mean, it depends on what question you're asking. The theory, there's the issues about the pole, the other pole, and so forth.
Well, no, just the question, is there a fixed point? Is there a zero of the beta function? I would have thought the perturbation theory would break down when you address that question.
Well, I think this is going to be addressed in Max Niedermeyer's talk.
There will be a talk about that, and the answer is no. So what we should do, as was mentioned, the one over S for the coupling constant in front of the right hand, so on. Squared. And this coupling constant is asymptotically free. So it seems to make sense to sort of rearrange the perturbative series as a formal power series in this S. And then obviously it will be well-defined at all scales. And it does not necessarily force any other of the couplings to be small. So we can actually look whether or not in the beta functions of the other couplings, the non-zero, non-trivial exponents, and the answer turns out to be yes.
But Lee is saying there aren't any other couplings.
No,
following your prescription of perturbatively renormalizable theory still has an effective action with an infinite series. The other couplings just go quickly to zero.
I think this is one of the main differences in the way how the beta functions are worked out in this ergier formalism and the standard perturbation theory is simply in this ergier type formalism. Beta functions are computed from the finite part of the effective action. In standard perturbation theory, they are computed from the divergent part of the effective action. And of course, much more is known about the divergent part of the effective action. And it has a very simple form which we can study.
There was a question by Jean Justin.
Just a thinking question. He was envisaging having finally a cutoff action. How do you envisage a covariant cutoff?
That is
That is what Elisa already explained. That is, in a sense, a choice you must make. The regularization of the path interval is a separate choice, and the one we took is you expand h mu nu in terms of eigenfunctions of d bar squared again, and then we took a sharp cutoff, really a sharp cutoff in the measure, not a suppression factor by means of e to the minus delta ks, but we just omit modes. Some people call it finite mode regularization.
And you're sure it doesn't violate locality?
Well, the scale is nil, of course, but
I mean, you would know that but complete theory would not like the idea of locality by sharp cutoffs. We like smooth cutoffs.
Yes, but this is non. I think this is not not crucial, but it is. It is an easy way to get.
I mean, if you do it in terms of the force, as for demand, you showed that ages ago that you get non-local counters.
Yes, but yes, you are right. That is if you are very precise, you would have to worry about that. But just to show that if you want to map Einstein-Hilbert onto Einstein-Hilbert at the bare level, we do not see that. But you are right, at the non-local level, it might do some harm to the possibility of getting a nice action for. I should put it that way, only the measure combined with e to the minus s has a meaning, and if I want to have a nice action, I should have a good measure, and the ones we used according to your argument would not be good. That's the point, but the product still can work.
I have a very general question about really the relation between what you're doing and what I was trying to do. The attitude I took in what I described, the work on cosmology, was that you have to take into account the complications you've discussed in calculating gamma k, in particular in finding the renormalization group equations for the coefficients in gamma k, and all of these things I was leaving to you and your colleagues. But if I take gamma k and assume these things have been calculated somehow, the beta functions and the location of the fixed point, and then I want to use it to try to see the cosmological implications, I don't have to worry about these things, the bimetric or the background independence or so on. Those complications arise only at the level, am I correct that those calculations only arise at the level of calculating gamma k, not at the level of using it?
That's right.
Thank goodness.
No, but the first answer is it is absolutely right, and the second answer is it might be advantageous to get familiar with these complications, because it might allow you to extract information from these calculations you could not get otherwise in practice. If you could do arbitrarily precise calculations, I think there would not be much point in doing all this gamma k business. You could use it to find what really the fixed point is and then to reconstruct the bare action perhaps, and then you can follow the usual lines of part integral quantization. For a purist attitude, you could forget about most of the average action business. But as in QCD, for instance, asymptotic freedom, it's very good to know that there is something like asymptotic freedom, just to understand that at qualitative level, certain features of phenomenology, and it would be not wise to say you should solve all the flow equation down to k equals zero and look at the resulting functional to describe phenomenology. That is certainly a correct procedure, and you would not have to worry about the cutoffs and all that, but it's just in practice not easily possible, except perhaps
just lattice methods and so on.
Well, I didn't mean to imply that one shouldn't worry about these things. I've tried to learn about these complications.
You are right.
But I just wondered whether I should feel guilty that I haven't completely succeeded in understanding.
No, and that's also an important point to what Max was saying. If you compute in standard perturbation theory counter terms the infinite parts of ordinary effective action, also there you would not have these problems. Just when we really want to use the effective average action as a machine which replaces doing the path in the curve, then we have to worry about it or asking how the physics of one planet mass manifests itself at 10 to the minus 30 planet mass if one wants to interpolate over vastly different scales.
I'm
afraid that this is very late.
Very quick. Okay. Well, for me, in your theory with the R squared, do you have a ghost in your theory?
But that's been debated widely and will be debated, but yes. Yes.
Because he is not in the solution that he's finding.
I say no.
Well, I think if you do the calculations in a way that you don't get a ghost, then you do have to include all the higher operators. That's my guess.
Yeah.
That Lee's approach, in which you don't have to include higher operators, does produce a ghost. And Niedermeyer's, in which you don't get a ghost, you do have to include higher operators.
I don't own that approach. I think it's a cautionary question.
Well, the approach to which you adverted.
Yeah.
Okay, so please keep your questions if you have any, for discussion session later this afternoon. And thank you.